This is Pittsburgh Explainer from 90.5 WESA. Every Friday, we help you understand some of the most important news stories from southwestern Pennsylvania. It's Friday, July 31st. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Liz Reed. Vice President Mike Pence was in Westmoreland County Thursday at a Cops for Trump event.
Well, hello, Pennsylvania!
Pence greeted a crowd of supporters outside the police station in Greensburg, most of whom weren't wearing masks or social distancing.
It is great to be back in the Keystone State to stand with Cops for Trump.
As protests against police violence and systemic racism continue across the country, Pence focused primarily on the administration's law and order message. He said law enforcement isn't the problem, it's the solution.
That's why President Trump and our entire administration back to blue, just like all of you. And we'll stand with the men and women on the thin blue line every single day.
And despite recent polling that shows Democrat Joe Biden leading Trump ahead of the November election, he expressed optimism about the president's chances of winning.
And I just know, looking at all the enthusiasm in this parking lot, and all the enthusiasm that I saw on the way here, that if all of us do all that we can between now and Election Day, here in Pennsylvania and all across America, we're going to win a great victory for the American people. We're going to send Sean Parnell to a new Republican majority in the United States Congress. And we're going to re-elect President Donald Trump for four more years.
Even if Republican Sean Parnell snatches the moderate 17th district from Democrat Connor Lamb, it's unlikely that Republicans will win enough seats to flip the House. And shifting demographics of the Commonwealth's electorate could make it more difficult for Trump himself to eke out the kind of win he saw in 2016. Here to explain more is Katie Meyer, political reporter at WHYY in Philadelphia. Katie, welcome to Pittsburgh Explainer.
Thanks for having me.
Now, it's not like the president had a landslide victory in Pennsylvania in 2016. He won by less than 1%, actually the narrowest margin in the state since 1860. So can you just remind us what kinds of voters put him over the top 4 years ago?
Right. So, I mean, there were several factors at work, but one of the really big ones is that Trump saw a very strong turnout among white voters, and specifically what demographers call white non-college voters. So people who have a high school education, often, or some college, but not like a four-year degree. And the reason, you know, that they, you know, define it that way is just because we do see very specific turnout patterns in that group. And in this case, so white non-college voters in Pennsylvania are about like 51% of the electorate, or they were in 2016, and they made up two-thirds of the voter base for Trump. So that's like, you know, it's not nothing. It's a pretty significant turnout. And so among that group, there was higher turnout. We've talked about this a lot. There was like that shy Trump voter effect in 2016, where people who were not being polled very frequently and people who were not expected to turn out did turn out in large numbers. So that was a big part of it. We also saw things like, you know, lower than expected black turnout for Hillary Clinton in cities like Philadelphia. So all of these things kind of coalesced into this, as you said, very narrow victory, 0.7% victory for Trump.
Were there certain areas of the state that made the difference for him?
In the analysis I did a little while ago, I looked at three counties specifically. Now, there were a lot of counties that had higher turnout for Trump in 2016 than they did, for instance, for Mitt Romney in 2012. But specifically, he flipped three different counties, and it was Erie, Northumberland, and Luzerne. Again, you know, those counties are all mostly white. Erie's 84%, Northumberland 75%, Luzerne 79%. And again, it was those sort of white non-college voters that made really big differences in those places. But again, those are not the only changes where votes in that population were much higher than previous elections for the Republican.
Are we seeing demographic changes in those areas or even in other parts of the state?
Yes, we are. And so this is not new, by the way. This is a trend that's been going on for a while in Pennsylvania and in lots of other states. But so one of the really interesting things that I found was that, you know, across the Commonwealth, the white population, specifically the white non-college population, is shrinking. So in Luzerne, for instance, which I think had a particularly notable change, so I mentioned it's 79% white, but over the last 4 years, the number of white residents shrank by 4.2%. Now, that's all white voters. Meanwhile, the number of black residents in the county grew by 13.9%, and the number of Latino residents increased by 26.1%. And so now that's, you know, Luzerne is just one example of this, but that is a big change, especially, you know, in the number of Latino residents. And so the demographers I talked to said, you know, this demographic change will never be the only thing, or would rarely be the only thing that decides an election, and it won't be in this case. However, it is significant. So one of the guys I talked to, his name's Roy Teixeira. He's a demographer. He's been doing a lot of work on demographics for many years. Basically, what he said is if all things stayed the same, which they won't, they never do. Candidates change, you know, circumstances change where there's a pandemic now. So lots of different situations, but...
For example.
Yeah, example. But if everything stays the same or stayed the same, the demographic change would be enough to change the result of the 2016 election. So if those conditions were replicated, it would be a different result with demographics of Pennsylvania now. So that's, you know, that's significant.
When I think back to 2016, I remember polls were showing that Hillary Clinton would easily win the presidency, even if Pennsylvania was still a battle. What are the polls and the analysts saying now? And should we still expect some surprises on election day?
I mean, you can always expect surprises on election day. That's what I always tell people who are like, how can we trust the polls again? It's like, listen, it was never 100%. And I think in 2016, we saw some misinterpretation of polling. You know, people were journalists, lots of, you know, people who talk about this stuff publicly were underplaying, you know, say Trump has a 30% chance of winning and Hillary Clinton had a 70% chance of winning. 30% is still significant. You know, it's not like that's no chance. So I think that there were a couple factors at play, certainly overconfidence in Clinton's chances among reporters and demographers who were interpreting their own polling. But also, yeah, we had, you know, people who were not being picked up in polls. And so the experts I've talked to said, you know, people have adjusted strategies. Pollsters have adjusted strategies over the last 4 years, trying to kind of hammer out those issues in 2016. But again, we're almost 100 days out. Trump is down in the polls. That's not a question. I think Joe Biden has somewhere around a 10-point edge on him in Pennsylvania right now, maybe a little bit less than that. That's not a polling error difference. And so, again, if the election were held today, you could be relatively confident that there would be a, you know, Biden-friendly result. However, it's not going to be. Things can always change. It is a pandemic. We don't know what is going to happen in either camp, in Trump or Biden.
Katie, thanks so much for your reporting. And I'm sure we'll be debriefing again come November.
All right. Thanks so much, Liz.
It's time for a quick break. We'll be right back.
I'm Dave Isay of StoryCorps. For years, we've connected loved ones through meaningful conversation. At this moment of profound political polarization, we're trying something new. It's called One Small Step. You come to StoryCorps to meet a stranger from across the political divides, not to talk about politics, but to get to know their story. It's an effort to help remind us that we're all just human beings. And WESA is helping lead our effort in Pennsylvania right now. Sign up at WESA.FM.
For 5 hours on Wednesday evening, parents, teachers, students, and others told the Pittsburgh Public Schools Board of Directors how they feel about a proposal to go online only for the first 9 weeks of the school year. WESA's General Assignment Reporter Kylie Kaczynski was watching the virtual public hearing and is here to tell us what she heard. Kylie, thanks for being on Explainer this week.
No problem, Liz.
What was the overall sentiment that people were expressing?
The vast majority of written statements were in favor of the change. Many teachers said returning to class would put not only them and their families at risk, but also students and their families. One teacher said something to the effect of she'd take a bullet for her students, speaking with regard to active shooter drills, but that she refused to be the gun, talking about spreading COVID-19 to one of her students. A few students wrote in too. A couple students were in favor of returning to in-person classes, saying that the online instruction was not robust enough. A few students claimed that they were just receiving YouTube video links and people were using search engines like Google to find the answers to questions, so they weren't retaining anything. But a fifth grader wrote in, and I found that testimony pretty compelling. 10-year-old Jacqueline Miller's testimony was read by PPS Family Youth and Community Engagement Project Specialist Linnell Reed.
I'm 10 years old and I have a hard time not touching my mask and face. So can you imagine the littler kids not touching their mask and face? School is not going to be the way we are used to. I worry about my little brother who's going into second grade. He has a really hard time wearing his mask for a long time. I do miss school and my friends and teachers, but I want us all to stay safe.
So there were teachers of younger students that also said there'd be behavioral challenges that they would face trying to keep young kids masked all day and not touching their face. Some pre-K teachers said that they do more than just instruct students 6 feet, 10 feet away in the front of a class. You know, they're opening juice boxes and snacks for kids, tying their shoes, zipping up their coats, things like that.
What were you hearing from parents? Because obviously it's really challenging for working parents, whether they're working remotely or working outside of the home and having to find childcare, to sort of monitor the online learning, making sure that's happening and also working. So where did parents fall in this?
The majority of parents fell in the camp that they would prefer their students to do online classes. There was, I would say, maybe 1 in 10 of the speakers were against doing online only classes. Some of them were parents, specifically parents of students with disabilities, saying that they would fall behind in their instruction. Only about one, maybe two people spoke with regard to how it would be difficult for them because school often serves as a sort of childcare, sort of daycare situation for many parents who go to work during the day. But the overwhelming majority of people that wrote in last night were in favor of online classes.
What are the next steps for the school board?
The school board will take into consideration the testimony they heard. They listened to about 140 different statements Wednesday night from parents, teachers, school bus drivers, etc. So Sean Albright, the region vice president of First Student School Bus Company, spoke about the risk of bus driver shortage that would happen if these drivers aren't brought back to their jobs. So school bus drivers have essentially been out of work since March when schools shut down, and many have collected unemployment. I know from personal experience, my mother is a school bus driver in Lawrence County, and she's been out of work collecting unemployment. Now, school bus drivers typically collect unemployment over the summer, and then they would start their job back up again in the fall. But with that potentially not happening, Sean Albright was concerned that many drivers will seek employment elsewhere. You know, a CDL license that you need to be a bus driver is in demand in other fields like truck drivers and things like that. So he thinks that there's a risk that school bus drivers, there will be a shortage of them, which is scary for families. You know, a lot of families get to know their school bus driver. They trust their school bus driver. And if there's a shortage and, you know, you've got one driver being in contact with more kids, perhaps you need to put more kids on a bus, something like that could happen. So he's concerned about that. And he's also concerned about the fact that these companies still have to do maintenance on these buses, regardless of if they're taking kids back and forth to school. And that costs money. And they've got employees at the terminals that they need to pay. And, you know, they're a contractor with the school. And so they were hoping that the school would sign some sort of deal with them to get some money to these companies. So they'll take that into consideration and they'll vote on Friday to see if this resolution should be put in place and which changes their plan for the first 9 weeks.
Kylie, thanks so much for your reporting, for staying up late on Wednesday night and watching this public hearing.
Thanks, Liz.
It's time for another break. Stay with us.
Are you a Pittsburgh musician waiting to be discovered? Have you been using quarantine to hone your talent and create new work? Well, don't miss your opportunity to sign up for the WYEP Singer-Songwriter Competition. August 7th is the deadline to submit your name before we draw our first round of artists. To register for your chance to perform, visit WYEP.org/singer-songwriter2020.
Several prominent Pittsburgh activists are facing multiple criminal charges related to protest activities in recent months. Supporters of the accused held vigil outside the municipal courthouse on Monday. WESA's government and accountability reporter Anlie Herring was there and joins me now. Anlie, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
What was the purpose of the Monday demonstration?
The group that had gathered outside the courthouse essentially was there in solidarity with some of the protesters who have been charged by Pittsburgh police for their alleged conduct at various demonstrations over the past few months. And speaking with some of them, people were saying that law enforcement essentially is taking attention away from the focus of the protests and these calls for more police accountability and focusing more on this alleged criminal activity that they say different protesters have been committing at the demonstrations. And beyond that, I heard a sense that police should use their discretion not to take such a heavy-handed approach to what they say marchers have done at some of these different protests.
Now, back in early June, dozens of people involved in the initial anti-police violence protests that were sort of at the end of May, beginning of June in Pittsburgh, they had charges withdrawn. It was like more than three dozen cases that the district attorney, Steve Zappala, directed charges to be withdrawn. What's the difference between those cases and the ones we're discussing today?
The DA's office said it dropped charges in those cases. There were dozens of them, like you said, because police simply hadn't furnished enough evidence to proceed with prosecutions. So the DA's office essentially dropped those cases. Here, with the more recent charges, police say that they have video evidence, eyewitness testimony, and that they feel like they have enough and can provide even more evidence as these cases move through the process to corroborate their claims in their criminal complaints against the demonstrators who are facing charges now.
So who are these activists and what are the charges they're facing?
Some of the people who have been charged are among the more prominent protest leaders in the area, and there are four of them who I reported on Monday, and they're all Black LGBTQ individuals. All of them face charges for a protest that took place outside a bar downtown on June 24th, and one of them, Lorenzo Rulli, also faces charges for a couple other protests before that. And then the U.S. Attorney's Office announced charges against eight more people on Wednesday this week. And all of those involved alleged offenses that took place at the protest downtown on May 30th. That was the first Black Lives Matter protest to take place in the wake of George Floyd's death in Pittsburgh and involved a series of confrontations with police and has garnered a lot of the attention. So there are multiple charges listed against these various protesters. They include things like riot, harassment, criminal mischief, criminal conspiracy. And that's not all that uncommon for police to just list all the charges that might apply at this stage. And that's what we're seeing here. At the one protest outside the downtown bar 941 Saloon on Monday, the police noted that the demonstrators chanted things like burn it down. So those are the kinds of facts that they're including in their affidavits. Also, the police say that the protesters trapped the staff inside the bar and jumped on a car and caused damage to that vehicle.
How about the federal charges?
The federal charges so far all involve the May 30th protest downtown, and that's where two police cruisers were destroyed and set on fire. So charges there involve damage to those vehicles. Also, there are allegations that some of the defendants threw rocks and even an explosive device at police officers. And they're also being accused of striking the police horses that rode in initially to try to disperse the crowd.
Anlie, thank you so much for your reporting and for being on the show this week.
Thanks for having me.
That's Pittsburgh Explainer for this week. Our show is produced by Katie Blackley. Christopher Ayers is our editor. You can find all of our news coverage at our website, wesa.fm, and of course on the air at 90.5 FM. I'm your host, Liz Reed. Thanks for listening. Let's talk next week.